This is GamesAtWork.biz, your weekly podcast about gaming, technology, and play. Your hosts are Michael Martin, Andy Piper, and Michael Rowe. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and are not the opinions of any organization which they have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 461, Lawsuits and Swimsuits. Sun's out. Pizza time. Hello and welcome again to GamesAtWork.biz, your weekly technology podcast. And we are now available in audio form because we have faces for radio on YouTube at GamesAtWork.biz. My name is Andy Piper and I am joined once again by my two co-hosts, Michael and Michael. I will throw it over, first of all, to you, Mr. Michael Rowe. How's it going?
Hey, Andy. I am doing well and glad to be back for another exciting episode. How are you, Michael?
Having a fantastic time, and many, many thanks, Andy, for getting us up on YouTube. This is going to be another interesting way to consume the Games at Work podcast, and we hope that our listening audience finds it useful.
Weren't we on Google Podcasts before that?
We were. We've been on Google Podcasts for the longest time, and Google Podcasts has only gone away, I think, in the US at the moment. But look, we've jumped through the hoops that we were required to go through to make sure that we were available on YouTube Music, etc., as a podcast. YouTube Music isn't the greatest place to discover podcasts. We are still available where you prefer to get your podcast, and you can get our RSS feed directly from our website, which you, of course, will come and visit on a regular basis. But if you do go to Games at Work...
And you can share it with your friends.
You should do that. Tell everybody to go to gamesatwork.biz and check us out. But if you do happen to go to our new YouTube channel, which has an audio feed primarily, you will find a couple of playlists of some historical archive footage of places that we've been on the internet together at different times in a couple of... They're not hosted on our channel, so they're playlists going off to videos elsewhere, but maybe worth a look.
Yeah, and you'll see the faces for radio then and there or in person, right? All right, yeah. Well, we have a fabulous show in store this week, and we wanted to start it off with security-related ideas and stories and capabilities because this has been all the news recently.
I didn't know you'd heard about this, Michael. I thought this was a surprise to you.
Well, not to me personally. So our first article, actually, I learned about it, Andy, from you this weekend about the XZ Utils issue. And it's a really intriguing story that I hope you'll set us up for. But it was your toot on Mastodon that alerted me to it. And I was like, wow, wait a minute. What's going on here? Let me find out some more and set it up for us.
Yeah, so it is an interesting and convoluted, involved story. The story of discovery was accidental. There was a particular developer whose name I'm fortunate I don't have in front of me. I'm sure it's in the New York Times and Schneier. We've got two stories, one from New York Times and one from Bruce Schneier's blog.
Andreas Freund?
Indeed. So from Microsoft. And... Yes. They essentially discovered that there was some strange behavior when they were running some testing some Postgres code. So this is like way outside, you know, database code, right? So it's not really in the remote access compression space at all. They found some unusual processor activity, decided to go digging, ended up managing to figure out that it was inside a piece of compression software, which is in a low-level library that's incorporated in a ton of different open source systems, Linux and otherwise, Microsoft as well, software as well. And yeah, it's low-level. It was very well disguised. And the other intriguing part is that it appears to have been a multi-process of essentially... Yeah. Maintainer of this low-level utility that people don't generally think about because it's not this kind of in-your-face sexy desktop or web service, you know, thing that we use every day. It's not the kind of thing that a lot of developers go out and you know, would necessarily be known for building.
However, that multi-year attack did get into a lot of, not, I guess you'd call them release candidates of Linux distros.
Absolutely.
As well as Homebrew.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
On the Mac.
Right. So indeed, and indeed into some Microsoft software releases already in different places. So, well disguised, it would have enabled remote access to anything remote, thing like SSH or something. It seems that there were sock puppet actors involved as well. So the individual or individuals that targeted this particular maintainer basically persuaded them or encouraged them or bullied them into giving them maintainership access to this release, this software, and then sort of sneaking this this exploit in under fairly innocuous release notes or history, using user identities on different forums or issue trackers to sort of say, well, this thing isn't moving fast enough. We need, you know, this should be handed over to somebody who's capable of maintaining it better. This individual that was maintaining that piece of code was, you know, evidently a relatively susceptible point to have that takeover occur. So really interesting from the perspective of the social engineering, also the technical engineering. And as Michael just hinted, you know, or stated, the fact that this this was ready to be wrapped up and released into next major long-term release candidates of Linux distributions like Red Hat and Ubuntu. So they were right. So Debian's based, Ubuntu's based on Debian. So absolutely. So there's this Russian doll effect of software stacks here, right? So we for example, Fedora, which is the sort of the fresh version of Red Hat that I, the community version of Red Hat that I use on my machines, they are about to release Fedora 40. It would have gone into that, would have gone into the long-term release of Red Hat. It would have gone into the long-term release of Debian and Ubuntu if it had got into the wild. And it would have been potentially difficult to detect again until somebody managed to spot a weird CPU spike that only occurred at a particular point in time. So really interesting, and not just because of the famous XKCD cartoon that's been around for a few years now, showing this kind of stack of software and this thing at the bottom of the stack that's just this tiny little thing that's absolutely, that's Michael Martin's holding up a cartoon style in the XKCD style, showing that sort of thing that's maintained by some unknown individual in Nebraska. There's a series of things. Well, so there's a series of things here. Somebody this week gave a post from last year, which was referring to the European Cyber Resilience Act, which was aimed at, as have some of the presidential decrees out of the US, have been aimed at securing the software supply chain. Now, somebody, an open source maintainer last year, posted in response to the Cyber Resilience Act, I am not your supplier. I am not, you know, my open source software, is released under a license that says all the risk is yours. This is released as is. You do what you want with it, but don't come and release it as under goodwill, as is. Another, where the FFmpeg library team released a conversation from last year where somebody from Microsoft Teams team had come along to their bug tracker and said, hey, this is a high priority, urgent issue, that subtitles are no longer being shown in this particular release. And one of the volunteer maintainers ended up going through the bug tracker and saying, well, yeah, that's because the command line options changed in this version of FFmpeg, and you obviously haven't updated your code to do this. And somebody else responded and said, yeah, it sounds like you need a maintenance contract for this, you know, you're Microsoft, right? And there was some back and forth, and eventually some one-off suggested but never provided. So there's a funding thing. What is the supply chain in this context when we're releasing, building on top of these things? And then there's a whole set of questions about the mental health of open source maintainers, the culture of open source, and as open source has grown, going well beyond the classic set of nerds working with each other and making cool stuff to actually, you know, the broader community running this, using this, and expecting certain behaviors and certain things, when in fact, you know, that may not be something you can rely on, and those people may not be in a good place. And I was talking to my wife about this last night, about the fact that the person maintaining this code, who's potentially, we don't know the full story here, but let's say they were tricked out of maintaining the code, or persuaded to give access to a broader set of people. Let's say that this hadn't accidentally, completely by chance, been uncovered and discovered. What would that have done to the and future of that person who had made that choice, that mistake? Because who knew? I mean, it's certainly nothing that couldn't have happened to other people. So
Andy, you hit almost every point
I was going to make. Sorry. Yeah, this is the Andy show.
So I think we're done with the show. Yeah. That was a great summary.
You're welcome.
The couple of things, and I was really hoping to get your perspective on this, because you've done work in open source.
A little bit.
You are a supporter of the concept of open source. And, you know, as in my day job, we use a lot of open source embedded into products.
So I heard.
Right?
I heard.
And I've always had that supply chain issue in the back of my mind of, in the corporate world, open source is seen as one of two things. Either free software development from somebody else, or the removal of risk by making that risk somebody else's problem. Both things that are great for shareholder value, and neither of them have, I believe, personally, recognize the value of the developer who actually provides that, which is your point you were making on, you know, maybe you ought to pay for support, right?
Well, but that doesn't solve the problem.
I was really wondering the perspective of, will this again have another chilling effect on the desire of developers to provide open source capabilities out to the world, right? Because you do it out of love for the challenge, or just, you know, I don't want to use the word altruism. It's sometimes it's just showing off a cool tech that you were able to pull off that nobody else could, right? I could rewrite Microsoft Word in a couple of million lines of less code that's even faster, and I'll do a, you know, Star Office or whatever it was. I'm making that up as an example. But either way, it's showing skills, but not necessarily getting recognition. You're not getting remuneration. And people are building their businesses on top of that without providing the value. And I think it goes into some of the discussions that we have on AI, too.
So first of all,
so I thought it was kind
money
of
a, isn't
it will be a nice feed
into necessarily
that.
Low likely is not the answer, right? Yes, support open source projects that are asking for that support, but a lot of them won't be asking for that support because they're just doing it for fun. They don't expect to give up their day jobs to be paid to do something else. They literally don't want to do that. They also don't necessarily want the control of their thing that they invented to be taken away from them, given to some foundation which has some resources which may enable it to be maintained longer term. I have been reading a lot this week as well about HashiCorp, Terraform, and OpenTofu at the Linux, the Cloud Native Computing Foundation, and the trade-offs that have occurred there. There's been another recent open source license change similar to the Terraform one, which is with Redis, which is an incredibly popular and well-used open source caching system, which incredibly interesting story there. It's stewarded by a company called Redis Labs. Redis Labs is not Redis Labs. They didn't invent Redis. They named themselves Redis Labs once they got control or having, you know, this, that's not true. They call themselves Redis Lab separately, and then gained control of the open source project at Redis, and then chose to change the license. The original creator and maintainer having left the picture, and that has caused all kinds of concerns for people who don't want to pay that organization for the support contracts that they're now asking for. And there's been a fork, or more than one fork, in different directions. And you know, I work on software which is also, which is strongly affected by both of those license changes, that uses Terraform for deployment and uses Redis for caching and so on. So there's a bunch of concerning moves around those, around the licensing. Is okay, well, if they weren't well funded to entertain those things, then who would be doing it? How would those things survive? So going back to your original statement about how open source is seen by large businesses, I think they may see it as a removal of risk. It's not. It's a huge risk. It's taking on of risk. And now coming back to this particular question, this is a system level library that is buried so far down the stack that if you were, I've been thinking this week about Apple, right? Because I use lots and lots of Apple stuff. I did patch my homebrew. I ran brew update as upgrade as soon as I'd read about this and got the latest updated version of XE. So everything in that bit of my land. I then went off and patched all my other systems. But
absolutely.
Well, right. How if I'm running software development for the whole of Apple, right? How do I know? You know, what level does that trust have to hit kick in that the underlying components that we're consuming can be relied on? We saw this a few years ago with an NPM module called Leftpad, where the maintainer just went rogue. And this is a tiny little JavaScript routine that pads out the left side of a string. I mean, this is kind of the kind of thing that you would historically have done in code yourself and written your own little routine for if it didn't exist in the language. Again, I mean, that module was used by so many other modules. Their dependencies were so intertwined that, you know, people had to, like, step in and take over that module and fix it. And the rogue maintainer or the rogue developer had to be booted off for ownership of the code on GitHub and so on. And it's tremendously complicated these days. The other thing I've been doing, and this is at this point, it's serious risk of becoming the Andy Show, and I apologize to our listeners for that, because that's not what you come for, I don't think. Maybe you do, in which case, keep coming back, folks. I'm still here.
Welcome to the Andy Show.
The other thing I've been doing this week, yesterday I went to the Victoria and Albert Museum, and this will make sense in a minute. Went to the Victoria and Albert Museum because next, the history of computer art, and there are some significant pieces from 50, 60 years ago in the Victoria and Albert Museum. And one of them literally is a huge piece of a mount board with six-inch square pieces of art created by computer. Oh, the first one of that sequence that comes before those pieces of art is the code printed out on a bit of dot matrix an old style dot matrix type printer. And I wondered to myself, what language is this? I recognize some of the structures in here, but I don't really know. So I took a photo, copied and pasted the code to an AI platform I had access to, and said, hey, dude, help me out here. What language is this? And they said, well, it looks like it could be Algol. It looks a bit like Pascal. There's a few things in here which don't quite make sense to me. I need more context. And I said, well, the context is it was written in this year by this programmer. That's what are the other information I know. And they said, this person was a noted computer artist, and it's a very good chance that they invented this programming language themselves, or they came up with this themselves. And I'm thinking, okay, well, so I'm not going to rerun this to recreate these things. But the point I'd wanted to make is that people at that point had so much ownership and the systems were that you wrote it all yourself. Now, there's so many dependencies that you just have to take. Generally speaking, we've survived very well on that trust for a significant, let's say, 30 years of open source software, 20, 30 years of open source software, nearly 25. And it's worked very well. And it kind of terrifies me if we have to get to the point where a large major piece of software, we have to put it all the way down the stack in every dependency to say, yeah, big check, we're done. And yeah, sorry, I will get off my high horse, but you asked my opinion, and those are some of my opinions.
Yeah, well, that's exactly where we did. And the one thing that you alluded to right at the beginning of all this, even when we were talking about what we did on our YouTube channel, Andy, started with trust related to identity. And if you think about how this particular thing happened, we had anonymous-ish sources of created accounts, sock puppets, I think is the words you used, right? That were badgering the maintainer to go do something.
Yeah.
It was not clear who those sock puppets were, whose hand was in the sock puppet. And for many of the open source related capabilities, it's not like there's an authenticated developer like your artist that you could find.
You see, the thing is that increasingly we have as a community, open source community, moved much more strongly in favor of known actors, secure commits, you know, signed commits, proof of identity. I recently, my GPG key expired after a year of use, and I went to pull or commit something on GitHub, and it said, no, can't do that. And I was literally like, okay, what do I do? How do I renew this? What command, what magic incantation do I need to fix this? And I found it. And then I wrote in my to-do list, write down what I did so that next year I remember how I did this. That was a week ago, and I haven't written down what I did. And I'm hoping that it's still in some shell buffer history somewhere that I can pull out or find the pages.
Future you will sort
future,
it out.
Future me will sort it out. But yeah, I mean, you're right. Again, going back to the recent presidential decree around memory safe languages and things, it's all very well to tell people to learn and use Rust and Java and other languages which do a better job in that respect. What it doesn't do is fix the culture problem, which leads to expectations, demands, bullying, or overly aggressive behavior under commercial pressure or otherwise. Maybe in this case, you know, there's a ton of options around what could have occurred here. It's heavily rumored that this could be, or suggested, and I think it's a reasonable assumption that this could be a state level actor trying to
over multi years, well, right?
But then funny time frame, the sock buckets and everything else, yeah.
But then a hilarious post. Well, it's a hilarious but darkly hilarious post came across my radar yesterday, where somebody said, you know, the year is 2035, and we're in a golden age of open source software, because all of it is maintained by state level security agencies who don't want to give away to the others that they're owning this code. So it's all basically being built in highly secure fashion behind the scenes by these sock puppets, actors of these security agencies, national of three or four major states. And yeah, it made me smile. But it also made me think. There's a lot of, we've just talked for 20 minutes about this, so sorry.
Welcome to the deep state.
This is the story, and the related ones. I mean, you said this right before we got started on our pre-show, our production meeting. How?
Let's call it that.
How it's. Yeah, that's, we'll call it a production meeting, right? How this is getting normalized, and the fact that such a thing is normalized and we kind of expect it is the words I think you used were not right.
It's infuriates me that we're not going to cover in detail here, but we had on our list that AT&T losing 73 million users. That's a lot of people, and that is a lot of very highly sensitive personal data. But, you know, oh, well, these things happen. Yes. You know, but they shouldn't, and that is highly well, you know, and this has happened. Yeah, okay, this has happened to lots of other companies over time. But it was only
10% of more active customers.
But there is no recourse to, you know, that somebody said, you know, that no, it wasn't the AT&T one. I don't remember which one. I think it was the DNA, 23andMe DNA one. That when these things happen, these companies should cease to exist. They have at that point fundamentally not, but they don't. They don't lose trust in the market. They lose trust of the users and their customers. They broke that trust, but not the trust of the capital owners.
Indeed. Who's the real customer?
Let's talk about something more fun.
Serve the customer.
Quick.
So.
All right. So Michael,
happy note.
Michael, wrap us up with, there's one last piece here about incognito mode. So.
Yeah. So with all this stuff, there's a lawsuit that just came out recently against Google because people are complaining that Google incognito mode was not secret. Now, because they had a spy guy icon, so obviously it was only stuff that's so secretive that a spy could use it. And basically, anything going through Google servers, they were taking the data and using it for their purposes. It's not secret. Safe mode is, I can't remember, Safari calls it personal or private mode or something like that. Firefox has a mode. All browsers have a mode. But let's face it, if you're going through the servers, it's not secret. So this is the difference between full self-driving trademark and actual full self-driving.
Yes.
Anyway.
All right. So. With that in mind, we have some fun AI things that take us in the next direction, which kind of lines up here nicely, too. So, Michael, I think you found this one from Stack Overflow about AI making our code worse. And we've talked a little bit about this sort of thing before.
Yeah, this is purely a follow-up article. It's actually a half-hour video audio podcast somebody who's promoting some library that they're making available or whatever. But they do talk about the usage of AI and how ultimately it is still your responsibility to make sure the code works, because if not, it's just going to be AI teaching AI teaching AI, etc. So I thought it was an interesting article. It came in my inbox right after I edited the show. And I was like, what? Were they reading my email again? I shouldn't use my Gmail account.
So our next lawsuit that's here too, that I really found intriguing, was one around reasons. George Carlin. And George Carlin is not actually out making comedy shows anymore, because he's no longer around for to make them, reasons. Right? But you can train an AI, just like you can train AIs to sing songs that couldn't have been sung by certain artists in certain Folsom County prisons, and create a show. So no surprise, there is a special that had been created in the style of George Carlin, and the trustees, I guess, the owners of the George Carlin estate objected to someone proffering of the name, image, likeness, words, etc., and said, hey, cut it out. Don't do that. And the article from Ars Technica on this was pretty funny in my mind, not just because it's a comedian, but also what has happened, the way it was described in terms of the author leveraging the AI capabilities to create this thing in the first place. And then the fact that in my mind, and we've said this before plenty of times, the internet is forever. So even if you take down the special, doesn't mean that somebody didn't download that special and they could be found elsewhere. And it'd be really horribly difficult for the person who did the creation and who took the action to remove it, now has absolutely no control over people that made unauthorized copies and that have now in turn popped them up on some other mechanism to allow people to find it and discover it. Life is just fun, isn't it? Isn't it? Sticking with the AI theme here for a minute, and on creation, we've had lots of new creative mechanisms in the last few recent days. We have an example here of AI creating a plain white painting. And Andy, as you're starting to talk about your example of the talk you're about to give, right? Hey, let's create a piece of artwork, which maybe is on thermal paper. Perhaps, you know, the code was written on it.
Yeah.
And that is now the piece of art. So telling an AI to create a piece of art that is just a white painting, well, sounds easy, doesn't it? But it's not.
I loved this web page and the whole story told, because he doesn't just, you know, say, look, I tried to get Dali to give me a plain white picture and it couldn't. He really dives into this in detail. Yeah. He gives you multiple prompts, multiple language models, multiple outputs to that. A lot of it is, you know, is things inside of the image, not just following the letter of the request to create a simple plain white thing. But the closest he ultimately gets really is this thing that is not completely a single uniform color, but this kind of average-ish thing, or what a human might imagine in their mind's eye when they're thinking of a blank space, but it isn't really completely blank because it might have a bubble or a thing in it. I think it really is interesting. It disappoints me a little bit just because I use a range of different tools that he's only tried a couple, Stable Diffusion and Dali.
Right.
Interestingly as well, we haven't had time to do it, and we're not going to have time to talk about this in any detail, but the CEO of Stability AI stepped down this week as well, and they're the people behind Stable Diffusion and other tools. So still so much going on in this space. But yeah, it comes back to the conversations as well about Stack Overflow and other things. Is the code making things worse? The entropy, it's creating this kind of averaging of everything, and that isn't always a great thing. I found, again, going back to my current hobby and exercise, just diving back into the 1960s in computer art, particularly the notion that computers didn't have immediately visible outputs and immediately interactive inputs in the 1960s. You were programming them on tape. You were potentially going from punch card to paper tape to another system, and then waiting some time to get something back in another format, and genuinely not necessarily knowing what the output was going to be.
What do you mean the 1960s? That was the early 1980s.
Well, that's also true. That's also
that's
true.
That's a description of
even better, even better.
It's a description of a prompt better. Engineer. Hello.
Even better was the discovery that one of the gentlemen, Frieder Naka, who was one of the sort of the creators of the movement, they received this drawing machine or this scanner machine or plotting machine at his university, and didn't get any software with it. So he had to write the software to make the thing do the thing. Brilliant.
Andy, just to close on that, I'm reminded yet again of your knack, your tactic of being able to do the Google searches in a way that nobody else could do the Google searches. And this
back
is yet again another example.
Back in the day when
that.
The Google searches were used.
So speaking of diving in, we have one last story, Michael, that was custom made for you, I think.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. So Form 2 has now new swim goggles, these AR goggles you've talked about. It's been a while. We'll have to find it in the last episode you did. What do you think about this new version? Is it compelling? What's your thought?
Yeah. So this is the Form swim goggles. They started off as a Kickstarter that I supported. I think it was a Kickstarter. Anyway, the great thing about them is they are AR goggles. They have an overlay that you can choose to put on your right or left eye, and it gives you metrics and information about your swim, when you do a flip turn, if you're doing open water swims, distance, pace, etc. And I've been using it for 5 years. I love them. I've gone through, this is my third pair, unfortunately. However, the failure has been on the battery charger, and they've just replaced them. I didn't buy them three times. I bought them once. And so the awesome thing about it is getting these glasses these goggles have been great for my swimming, because I tend to lose track where I am. Wow. Am I on, you know, lap 36 or 38, right? Because I do long distance swimming over a long period of time. So what this new set is they add two features. One, a heart rate monitor. And the other, which I find interesting, but I don't do open water swimming as much anymore, is the ability to make sure you're going straight. So think of a GPS for swimming.
Lane departure violations, right?
Yeah. If you've tried to, have you how people drowned out in the ocean?
Yeah, they keep on swimming the wrong way. Or that.
Swim in a circle because of different things in open water. Your brain and the way the your balance and stuff in the ear is and a bunch of other things cause people to swim in a circle, and they eventually just drown because they die. Right, they ran out of energy and die. And so this will allow you to set a target and swim straight. I think this is a great addition. They recently added updates in the software about a year and a half ago, and I was a beta tester of it for coaching to teach you what you're doing while you're swimming, you know, check how your head is going, are you breathing correctly, or et cetera. But they've turned – the new goggles are about 30% more expensive. I mean, they've gone up in price, and they've become a service. Swim as a service. So you can buy a monthly coaching contract. I do not plan on upgrading to this until mine die. So, think it's cool, and I love them. I do love them. I don't pay for the monthly service. I tested it. It was good, but it wasn't good enough. If I were a triathlete or a marathon swimmer, I probably would.
And to prove that we've been in this space for a long time, you can go back to 2020, episode 270, and 2021, episode 335, and hear us and almost certainly Michael talk about the Form Swim goggles some more.
Yep. Your Google foo is strong today.
I was right on it.
And we know it's an authenticated Michael because we were there to hear him talk.
Right. Yes.
There's no proof.
Just playing.
Could have edited it.
It wasn't his Apple persona. It was the real version of him, not the AR version,
or the AI version. That's coming later. All right. Well, team, I think that's where we leave it for today. We've got a couple more stories that we're excited about. We'll loop them in next week. Send us your stories. Check out the YouTube videos, or not really videos. They're audio with the
picture. We won't loop them in next week. They'll be in the show notes.
Yeah. You never see.
We never catch back up.
I'm going to put them in the show notes for next week, so you'll see too. Anywho, we hope you have a wonderful week. Thanks for listening in again. We are delighted that you have, and tell your friends, and we will be back again next week for another edition of GamesAtWork.biz.
See ya.
See ya.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming, technology, and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.